And we got quite a lot of questions. Some really good questions. So we'll alternate reading a question, and then we'll probably both have something to say about the question. And we may not get through them all. We have a couple more of these Q&A times planned, so we won't. We may come back to some of the ones that we don't get to today. So, a couple questions about thoughts. I have thought that during a meditation sitting, I should try to stay in the present by, for example, focusing on the body and or breath. But I think you're saying allow thoughts to come and notice them, explore them. If I do that, I'm afraid the entire time will be my thinking about all kinds of things, like my next vacation or what we're having for dinner. So this almost a little fear or a view that allowing thoughts in our mindfulness will just be taken over by them. This is a pretty common perspective, especially for people who've done kind of a more focused meditation practice. Because in many meditation practices, we are cultivating a more a concentration more on staying with one object. And the instructions there are to let go of thinking and come back to the breath. And in that kind of a practice, in some ways, thoughts are taking us away from the aim of the practice, which is to settle the mind with some particular experience, like the breathing. And so that kind of teaching it's a very familiar teaching. Many of us have done practices like that. And it has its use, it has its place in our practice. At times it's really useful to turn our attention to something and cultivate a stability of mind on that experience. But a view that can come about based on that style, not that the people who teach that style say this, but there's the view that we can't be mindful if we are thinking often, that we believe that if we let thinking happen, if we get curious about thinking, observe thinking, then we won't be mindful. So that's the first piece, that to kind of break that notion that being aware of thought means basically that we'll be lost in thought the entire time. And I will say that being aware of thought, as Sayadaw sometimes says, do you know a thought is just a thought? That's kind of the fundamental instruction or the fundamental check. If you're aware that a thought is a thought in the present moment, then you're aware of thinking. There's a vast difference between knowing a thought in the present moment as a thought in the present moment and being involved in thinking about that thought. So that's what we explore learning, how to be aware that a thought is just a thought. And I would say that in general, thoughts are... we have a really strong habit of delusion with thinking, that we tend to believe our thoughts, we tend to get absorbed into our thoughts, we tend to kind of take up residence in the world the thought creates. And so it's a very potent habit, that getting lost in thought. And so it takes some stability of mindfulness to begin to really be able to see thought as thought, which is partly why we waited until day 3 to just talk about it, really, the, you know, how you know, working with thought and beginning to investigate this, you know, how do we know a thought is just a thought? It's not an easy object to become aware of because of the habit of delusion, the habits that we have around thinking. So that's kind of the frame here, that if you find that trying to be aware of thought, you do just get lost in the vacation or the, you know, thoughts about what's for dinner, probably mindfulness isn't quite strong enough yet to know that a thought is just a thought. So I would say that a couple of tools that I'll offer for beginning to recognize that thoughts are just thoughts. The first one is it's still engaged with the content a little bit. What I would say is that usually when the attention gets pulled thoroughly into the content, it's stuck on the details of what we're thinking about. And so the mindfulness gets kind of hooked to the details of the content. And so one step back from that is to recognize kind of the kind of thinking. We've talked about this a little bit, that we might recognize that planning or remembering or judging or fantasizing or arguing, daydreaming is happening. And so that's still acknowledging that content is happening, but you're step back from the detail. It's kind of more the general picture. And you can know that is happening. You can just acknowledge, yes, this kind of thinking is happening. This kind of thinking, daydreaming is happening. Another step back from the content, and this one has been very, very helpful for me. This is most useful if there's not a lot of emotional charge to the content, but it's just like random thoughts coming in, is to recognize the process by which thinking is happening in our minds. There's different ways that we think. We can begin to see this as we explore. As we sit here and watch our minds, we start to recognize that some thoughts appear as images in our mind, or maybe as full-blown movies with acting and a soundtrack. And so sometimes it's just like images, sometimes it's moving images, sometimes it might be as if somebody is talking to us, sometimes it might be as if we're talking to ourselves, sometimes it might be the feeling of doing something. I know that from my time as a dancer. Sometimes I would, the experience of doing a move in dance, would be like my body was doing it. So it was like almost the feeling of doing it. That's also a kind of thought, like thinking about doing a particular dance move. It would feel like the body was doing it. So that's another way, kinesthetically, we can experience thought. And so this is really a step back from the content. This is acknowledging for ourselves, how do we know that we're thinking? How is thinking happening for us? And for myself, I've acknowledged that in terms of the modality. So I would even use some kind of little gentle labeling or noting at times of, instead of it being like seeing instead of it being thinking or planning or remembering or judging, I might notice seeing is happening. I know that I'm not literally seeing, but that the thought is appearing in the mind as an image, and that's what's being acknowledged. So that's noticing the process of the thinking rather than the content of the thinking. So that's a really useful tool. Then the other piece I'll point to is that, so as we have a thought, it's like the mindfulness just gets gravitationally pulled to it. It's like the thought is a magnet, and the attention just like get stuck to that thought. And there's a lot of things going on in the present moment besides the thought. So another exploration is kind of to consciously broaden what we're noticing. It's not saying, oh, thinking, come back to the breath, but it's more, this thought happens. Thoughts happen in our mind, and boy, tons of stuff come along with when a thought arises in our mind. Even a word or two can trigger a whole complex of an emotional response in the body and feelings in the body. And so associated with that thought and the content of that thought can be a whole range of other experiences that are connected to the thought. And so we may have the attention kind of pulled into the thought, and I'm thinking, let's try to like expand the mindfulness so that if the thought is like the size of a tennis ball, let's expand the mindfulness to see, you know, what's around that tennis ball. What are the emotions that are present? How's the body? Maybe what purpose is this thought serving? So those are some kind of questions that you could use to explore, not knowing the thought itself, but the impact, I'd say the impact of the thought on our system. And that that begins to, because often when we have thoughts that, particularly that have a lot of emotional content, we need to begin to explore the whole field that the thought is coming in, and not just that we're thinking. So those are some thoughts about thoughts.
As you were talking about thoughts, I was thinking that I thought, well, I'm not sure if we have enough questions because, you know, we have, what, I don't know, 8 questions, and we'll get through those easily. And I realized, no, when you ask a Dharma teacher a question and it's about the Dharma, there is so much to say. And we're Dharma nerds, and we just kind of that's so much, it's so rich to explore. Thoughts, it's such a, I mean, in some ways, yeah, this is our big work in the West is thoughts. You know, it's, I think, therefore, I am, right? That whole idea of we've made thoughts kind of the supreme part of our sense of self. I believe. I remember not really being able to, in any way, sense who I am without thought, without thinking about myself. And that's a really big exploration, is to start to elevate other qualities of mind, like being aware as equally valid in the moment of, you know, in this moment to actually experience outside of thought. And most people will never get to taste anything other than their thinking mind. Everything comes in and it's experienced only through thought, not through being aware, being sensitive to what's going on, being awake. So this is a particularly fruitful place for us, you know, as practitioners to wake up to. As Andre was sharing, I was remembering a time when I was reporting to Sayadaw Burma about these repetitive thoughts that were just going on and on and on. And he just dropped in one question that helped around particularly sticky territory for me, because if I am my thoughts, then of course if I'm thinking about something, it feels like I should be thinking about it because that's who I am. And I, you know, if I let that go, I don't know who I am without that thought pattern. But I would, you know, I was telling him about this particular thought that would come up 1,000 times. You know, I think I was planning something out or wondering maybe if I should disrobe or, you know, leave the monastery. So he said, just ask yourself, is it useful, this thought, is it useful? Which in a way, it's like you're using our own thought, dropping in a question like that. Is this useful or is it necessary? I think maybe is one that you mentioned. So we're not only kind of surrendering to the flow of thoughts. We're getting interested in the nature of thoughts, partly by allowing them to be there, discovering how powerful they are, and really seeing how much of our mind habitually or addictively is just spinning in thoughts that really don't serve a purpose, but because they're not known, there's no way out of them. Right? When a thought becomes recognized, seen, we actually have a chance to respond. Right? We can say, is this necessary to keep feeding? Is this necessary? Not aversively, just kind of dropping in that interest. Is this necessary? So, really rich terrain. And it does take some days of steadiness for the mind to have the capacity to sense into thoughts, into that territory of seeing our own minds walking, you know, as we're walking about, how much we're thinking about our experience, which isn't wrong. It's just, you know, tends to magnetize the attention towards more of a conceptual experience. And we're really losing touch with what's here. And so one Dharma teacher I've heard share this, saying something like, if, you know, the thoughts of your mother or your family member are more real than the experience of your sitting here or your being here, then it's time to meditate, is their particular phrase. You know, and that's often the case. Our thoughts become actually more real than the reality of this breath, this moment, this being here. And that's the seduction, the story of the thought, the story of thoughts. And yet thinking is a reality, just like an emotion is a reality, breath is a reality. So when we remember that thoughts are part of this natural process, then okay, that's not about getting rid of anything, but it is about waking up to what it is and how powerful it is when it's not noticed. So, another thought question, and we'll see where we go. So would you talk a little more about your friend's harmful thought practice and or working with harmful thoughts as they arise in the mind? So the referencing this friend who was with Sayadaw Pandita, I haven't listened to the talks, so I don't know particularly what was spoken about. But in those talks, which I hadn't really considered that much before, which was the impact of our thinking and the sila that's possible around being careful with our own thoughts as a function. Right now, thoughts happen so fast, they're so quick. How do we become, you know, as a restraint, how do I not think things that are harmful? And I'd say this is one of the reasons why sila as ethical guidelines doesn't include thoughts. Because if we said something like, don't think a judgmental thought, right? It's like, don't think about ice cream. Right? Now we think about ice cream. So we can see how the mind, we don't have that kind of freedom with the mind to kind of control it. So thoughts are not necessarily in our control. But when we're not aware of the impact of our own thinking, I think we're not necessarily as sensitive to paying attention, right, to the power it has. And in fact, we suffer predominantly from the stories that we're telling ourselves, from what it is that we believe. So beliefs in the mind, stories, ideas about the world, things that should or shouldn't be, all of those are rooted in that category of thought, belief, ideas, views. So I'd say most of our work around the kind of the result of our thoughts is probably more as a mindfulness, kind of accompanying thoughts as they happen, so that we can learn about what is an unskillful thought. So when a thought is rooted in a sense of aversion, judging, shame, irritation, so it's rooted in these qualities, how does that feel? And if we are sensing that, if we're open to that, we really can start to turn to our attention to the harm that that causes our own mind, and being compassionate rather than judging ourselves for having a mind that does something like that. Right? This is just activity of mind, habits that are very deeply ingrained in our own personality structure. And it's almost like the last person at times that we will bring kindness towards is our own being, our own self. But one of the ways that we are violent inwardly is through thought. And just by recognizing that, I think, we really can start to let those patterns go. We see it. There's some patterns that are particularly strong for me. And I see the thought coming, and I know it's going to pull me down with it and believe, you know, it's going to invite me. And I know beforehand it's a thought pattern that hurts. But it's so familiar as who I am. I can see it coming from miles away. Know it's going to bring me to some terrible place. It arrives and I say, let's go. And all right, let's go. I'm ready for you. You know, I'll lead the way. I know where to go. And we go there. Ow. Like, ouch, that hurts. But seeing that again and again, seeing it slowly, there is now this, it's like I'm in that wobbly state. It's like, it's just a thought. And ouch, it still hurts. It's just a thought. And there's some, you know, the sense of self still gets entangled in it. So, you know, in really deep conditioned patterns like that, we go through this transitional phase where it's being seen. There's still that kind of rub that hurts, and there's some letting go. And we see that transition is happening. I'll pause there.
I guess the piece I'll add around working with or recognizing unskillful thoughts and the kind of direction they can not only take our minds but lead us into actions in the world. But sometimes those, you know, as Alexa said, sometimes they have a really strong power to them. And certain thoughts for myself, for instance, thoughts of self-hatred, you know, I would think those thoughts, and the main harm that came was to me. You know, I'd just be sitting there hating myself. But some thoughts may have impact, you know, want to kind of be leading us into how we engage in the world. And there are times when we may actually want to have a kind of a firm hand with our unskillful thoughts. So this is where we begin to recognize, again, it's almost like we talk about with overwhelm, when we're overwhelmed by something in our meditation practice and the mind can't really meet it. That's not a good object to bring mindfulness to at that point. If the mind is full of aversion, it's not the time to look at something that we're really averse to. And so sometimes a thought pattern or something is so sticky for us that we may need to, as we do in our meditation around difficult states of mind or overwhelming states of mind, use some strategies to bring the mind back to balance, to basically just say, you know, I see you and I'm going to put my attention someplace else. So we may need to do that at times with difficult thoughts or with unwholesome thoughts. Basically using our understanding, this is an unwholesome thought, hopefully not with aversion to the unwholesome thought, but we may have to just simply recognize that there may be aversion to that thought. We're going to have mixed motivations, mixed relationships to our experience for a long time. And so we may recognize, yeah, that's not such a helpful thought. which has a flavor of compassion to it. And we may also at the same time really be so frustrated with ourselves for thinking that thought yet again. So both of those may be coming up. And what I try to do and suggest that people can explore is recognize that both of those intentions are there, both that intention, like, I really just want to get rid of this thought, and I'm so angry with myself for thinking that thought again, and yet recognizing, yeah, and it's not helpful to try to be mindful of this right now. So there's a compassion there. There's a compassion to that. If you can connect to that intention of compassion in stepping away from the thought, you may still have some of that aversion to the thought, but at the same time, you know, the compassion that understands, or the wisdom that understands, this is not helpful. It's like it's helping us to let go of something that's more unhelpful. So it sometimes the letting go process around working with unskillful thoughts, it can kind of be staged. You know, we let go of, we may have some aversion, like, I can't think that thought, better not think that thought, better like change the channel, better like, you know, ooh, I got to get rid of that one. So there may be a little aversion in there, but that aversion may is probably also connected with compassion. And any aversion that's there may be helping you to let go of something that's even bigger, even more unwholesome. At some point, we do have to really acknowledge the subtler kinds of aversion. You know, so there are times in our practice where we are, you know, we're paying attention, and there's a thought, and it's like, oh, that thought, forget it. And it's just the subtlest kind of push away. And we actually, at that point, have the capacity to meet that thought and know the aversion of that thought. But we've developed this belief that shouldn't go there. And so there's a stage in our practice where we do have the capacity to do exactly as Alexis said, even for very sticky thoughts, that we can know it's a thought and know that we are buying into it and see the pain that's being caused from that and be able to watch that whole thing as a process. So we have to have some discernment about whether we can stay mindful. And that's what I'd say is the main guideline we can use there. If you know that you're thinking, even if it's an unwholesome thought and it's continuing, if you're able to stay mindful, probably there's enough mindfulness to be understanding something about it. If you start to find that being mindful of that kind of a thought pulls you into the rabbit hole of it and you lose mindfulness, that's not so helpful to be mindful of. Oh, my turn again. So I'm going to skip another thought question, because we've spent half an hour on thoughts. To another topic, I'll read three here that are related. What is the role of compassion and kindness in this practice style? It seems to take on a positive role in this practice. Isn't metta considered wise intention or wise attitude? Please explain the role of kindness in this style of practice. A passive role. It seems to take on a passive role in this practice. Isn't metta considered wise intention or wise attitude? Is there a role that loving kindness can play when working with strong mind emotional states, not as a fix or cover up, but as a support? And tell me something you know about love. So, metta is considered a wise intention. In the Buddhist teaching, it is understood as wise intention. And in this practice, the place I really see it coming is the framing of this practice is that we are exploring the possibility of a mind that allows what's happening to be happening, the mind that can be at ease and allow what's happening to be happening. That mind state or attitude of allowing, in my own understanding, allowing is love. It is, and that allowing attitude, when we open to allowing something, when we open to allowing beautiful states of mind, and we know that we're with beautiful states of mind. So, you know, we notice, we recognize in the moment that we're able to be with something with balance of mind. Even something challenging or difficult, a challenging or difficult state comes up, and we're able to be balanced with it. If we check into the attitude there, and I talked about this, you know, when things feel like they're going fairly well, yeah, I can be with this frustration, and it's not a problem. What's your relationship to that? The allowing attitude there, we begin to touch into a whole host of beautiful qualities of mind, including love, and in this case, maybe including joy. Because when a mind of love or connectedness, that's another word for metta, I think, is really connection. A deep connection and intimacy with another person, with experience. And that's what we're practicing here, is connectedness. And when that connected heart, that heart of allowing, meets something beautiful, that mind that can be balanced with something difficult, delight can arise. It's like mudita for ourselves. Gratitude. It's a form of the Brahmaviharas, that quality of heart. When something challenging is arising and there can be struggle there, when we can see that with balance of mind, compassion is the natural result when that heart of allowing meets a difficulty. And so the opening to our relationship to experience is really where I see the metta quality, the love quality, beginning to experienced and cultivated. And so the cultivation of love in this practice comes through the wise attitude, comes through exploring that balance of mind with allowing and recognizing it. So one of the best ways to cultivate love is to notice it's happening. And so often as we're exploring this particular practice in particular, I think sometimes we more are orienting towards, okay, can I be with this? And that's a lot of the language we use. And so I see why these questions are here, because we don't speak about this so much. I would say it's not a passive role that metta takes, because it's a hugely alive force in our practice in meeting our experience. This quality of allowing, of openness, of connection, of intimacy, of love, all of these words are frame, in effect, how we connect to the practice. And when we, if we're not orienting and opening to the experience of wise attitude, we may miss that these qualities are developing. But one of the best ways to strengthen love, here's one thing I know about love. One of the best ways to strengthen love is to be aware of it, to know that it's happening. So I'll let you say some things if you want to say anything.
I'm going to recreate it. Love. It's such a powerful word. So I'm going to ask you, what blocks love? What blocks love? Aversion. What blocks love? Oh, aversion, someone said.
Judgment.
Anger.
Fear.
Separation.
Delusion.
What is it?
Delusion.
Nothing. Everything. It's interesting what love is, right? I think it's like, in my own experience, something that I've cast out from my mind that I say doesn't belong, I really feel that I don't love that. And very difficult to love everything. Very difficult. I mean, love is also very natural to us, to the mind. So this is both paradox to me. It's like we're equipped, born to love. And yet, I think through misunderstandings of how to be safe, we go in the opposite direction. So we avoid, we try and circumvent. I think in search, basically, of something that we call love, which is to feel complete and whole. So when I'm watching something in my own system, my own heart and mind, and these are deep patterns that are so unpleasant to my mind, the most radical thing to do is to say, this belongs. Right? This belongs because it is part of what arises here. I'm experiencing it. It's my mind. It's my mind. So then when we really understand the nature of the mind, right, we say, point to something right now that's not arising in your mind. Right? I'm arising in your mind. Right? The room is arising in your mind, in your awareness. If you weren't aware of it, it doesn't exist for you in this moment. Any thought, any emotion arising in our own minds, and yet we resist and judge and react to things that are actually as close to us as our own self is. It's us, the mind. So love really is a path of opening, of receiving, of allowing. And yet we can't really do it as much, right? We can't do that because the mind has its own nature, has its own patterns. But what we can do is see the reactions. We can see how our views will push some things away. And that really this path of beginning to move towards, of allowing, being with nature, oh, that's love, right? That's what, you know, when we know these qualities are what we ultimately want, and that's kind of, to me, what that movement is in the Dharma. It's, you know, like I can experience my own, like I'd say stickiest pattern is shame. That's a really strong one. I can feel shame very easily. To learn how to love shame as a phenomenon means I'm not afraid to feel it. And if I'm not afraid to feel something, then I can be in conditions and situations that pattern now is back into my system as something that I'm okay with. It's here. It's all right. Oh, this is here. And then if I'm having a problem or a difficulty with someone, and I see that person, someone in my family, and if I have this aversive stance, there's no way to have love. And it's interesting, but the very first person that's experiencing that lack of love is myself, because that's, in a part, that's my mind, that's me. It's my consciousness I'm seeing or remembering or an image. So we think of things that are not allowed into our mind. can also see it as part of what's blocking the ability to love, to be open. But love is such a, it's a Western word, you know, that has so many meanings, and so it's not often we use it in the Dharma language, because then what do you mean by love? And sometimes what we mean by love in the West is, or just in common language, is very strong attachments and clinging. But then when we see, if we really attach and cling to something, we have an agenda for it. And that person, that thing doesn't feel free. And so that's not, to me, like, what does it mean to love something? So it's deep, for me, it's a very deep inquiry of discovery. And really, at its base level, I think part of what we're doing, and it may seem kind of dry and technical when we say things like, you know, watch the attitude of the mind. But if it, you know, if it awakens the interest in the heart, to use a different language, like, is there love in relation to this experience? If that touches it more deeply, then we can use that word. Yeah.
Something Alexa said just brought this into my mind. You know, when I thought about what I wanted from love, you know, in terms of relationship, or, you know, so much I think of what we want is to be seen and accepted for who we are. You know, when we want somebody to love us, you know, that's what we'd like from them. You know, just somebody to love me unconditionally, to take me exactly as I am, and you're probably not going to find another person that will do that. You might. I mean, there's some amazing teachers out there that might have that capacity. But this is what we're trying to do for ourselves. This is our practice. As Alexis pointed to this, I think, a little bit indirectly, but we are learning to love ourselves here. It's completely intertwined with what we're doing. That learning that, you know, so much we want to be seen for who we are exactly, and that's what we're trying to do here. We're exploring seeing ourselves. No part left out. There's that beautiful image by a poet, watching the moon, solitary mid-sky. I knew myself completely, no part left out. That encompasses to me both the connection of mindfulness and the love of that meeting. And so we can see ourselves that fully. That is so much what we're looking for from others. We can do it for ourselves.
So there's a question, I'll just read it because I think we sort of touched this a bit, but what does this practice do to our positive emotions? Do we feel more or less? If less, then why do it? Do you feel like we did enough?
I think there's some piece to answer.
Okay.
So one of the great things about mindfulness is that it's got this like magical quality that when we turn our attention, we open to, we allow our difficult mind states. It creates the conditions for those difficult mind states to become less frequent in our minds. And I think this happens because essentially what happens as we become aware of difficult mind states is that our system understands, ouch, that's suffering. Before we're really mindful, when difficult mind states or reactivity is arising, there's some delusion that's covering our minds that somehow has us believe that this difficult mind state is doing something for us, is helping us in some way. And so as we bring mindfulness into the picture with these difficult mind states, it's like, it's so obvious, this is not helpful. And so it creates the conditions for those states to weaken. So mindfulness does that with difficult mind states. And we see that, you know, we see that process happening. And so we think, well, oh, if I look at my wholesome mind states, then they're going to go away too. But fortunately, what happens with mindfulness of wholesome mind states is that the heart recognizes, and it's like it sings with these wholesome mind states. It's like, yes, this is helpful. This is the direction towards freedom. And so becoming mindful of our wholesome mind states of love, of compassion, of concentration, of mindfulness, of patience, of curiosity, a whole host of beautiful supportive mind states, as we become mindful of them, it creates the conditions for them to become more prominent in our lives. So mindfulness is the magic bullet. It's just not really, you know, acting instantly. But it doesn't matter what's arising. The mindfulness, and my understanding is that it's partly because our system as organisms, our human organism, has this pull towards well-being. And just basically, fundamentally, delusion completely misunderstands how well-being is to be found. And so we get completely caught and lost in patterns that don't support us. But as we bring mindfulness into the picture, that those patterns of that block well-being become seen as blocking well-being. And so the mind gets an education about what's actually helpful and what's not helpful. And we don't have to do it. It's like our system is organized this way. At one point, Gill said something like, there's a biological imperative towards freedom. It's kind of what I think he was talking about, that as we open to what's happening with mindfulness and not rejecting anything, the system understands how to let go of the unhelpful and shores up and grows the wisdom, the compassion, the love, the joy, the curiosity, the kindness. So, yes. This practice increases the wholesome states.
I agree. Okay. So you said it's okay to not know what the object of awareness is. I think you said that. Okay. What do you mean by that?
Do you know what I mean?
I think so. Okay. And then the next one says, is an object something like the breath, a flower, etc.? What do you mean by object? And please give an example. So is it okay to what the object of awareness is? I think what Andrew was pointing to, and I'll let you give more detail, but there are times when there is this, once we are becoming more familiar with being mindful, with being established in being aware, in contrast with being lost, it's like, oh yeah, I'm aware right now. And I think there are times where we're not quite sure, and this might arise in different ways, but I'm not quite sure what it is specifically that I'm aware of. Sense of being aware. Now, what is it? Right, and it might be that just by dropping that question in and bringing up different ideas, we might clarify what it is that the mind is knowing. Like something like calm is often overlooked as something that we might be aware of. Or the positive states of mind, like concentration. We can be aware when concentration is present. We can be aware when mindfulness is present. We can be aware when wisdom is present. And if we don't necessarily perceive it directly, that perception making the object be revealed to the mind, then there can be this sense of just being aware. And at that time, I would say it's okay to just take the awareness as something that we are identifying, that we're aware of. Yes, I'm aware right now. I'm aware. In my own practice, I personally feel it's useful at times to strengthen the awareness or really support it by just dropping in that question, and what is the mind aware of? What is it knowing right now? And just to continue that kind of connection of, yes, there's awareness, it's knowing this. Because I think sometimes when we just stay inward in the awareness, I think it can easily lead to a little proliferation or conceptual thinking about the experience rather than directly knowing it. And then I'll just say just a word about objects. Objects sound very, it's like distant or depersonalizing it, but it means whatever we can know is an object. Whatever we can know directly. Right? So we can know our sensations directly. We can know our thoughts directly. We can know sounds directly. But we hear the sound, let's say, of that car, right? And we can't experience the car, but we think about the car. So we're experiencing directly the object of thought. And we can also know that the mind is having an image in the mind of car. Right? So anything the mind knows then is what we would say is an object. But oftentimes, particularly around seeing, we think that I'm seeing, and the question here was a flower. We're really seeing color and form. And then the mind says flower. But then we start talking, we have this perception and memory, oh, this is a flower and it's beautiful and I love flowers and I wonder how it smells and, you know, this would be a wonderful gift to my partner or whatever our minds will say. But the actual experience, so when we give the instructions, for example, of really practicing with a sense door of seeing, it's not to then name object after object of concepts of things we're seeing, like looking up here and Buddha statue and Alexis and shawl and Andrea, you know, and wall and window. It's even more simple, which is just the activity of seeing. Oh, I'm seeing. And we can be aware that the mind is recognizing, this is more subtle, but the activity of perception is we then recognize what it is we're seeing. And if you ever look at something that you didn't quite, you weren't quite able to understand because it's, you know, it's a geometric shape, let's say, and you don't know if it's close or near, and the mind is kind of trying to figure out what it is, what you're doing right in that moment is experiencing the activity of perception very clearly. And you're seeing, but you can't land on the thing. What is that? You know, if you look at a image in a magazine, it takes a second to figure out what it is. It's a fascinating process. But we take perception so automatically that we think we're just seeing the world. But we're seeing, you know, we're experiencing perception of sights. We don't need to do that as a mindfulness practice, because really any moment of being aware of anything is supporting our awareness. So just by remembering that we're seeing, that's enough. Oh yeah, I'm seeing. But if we start naming things, then very easily we might get into the story of it in a conceptual relationship. I hope that makes sense. I'll let Andrea clarify.
I thought it made sense.
Okay.
The one piece I'll just elaborate on with respect to knowing the awareness and not knowing what we're aware of, I think that does start to happen more as we do get more familiar with the feeling of knowing the awareness, as we get familiar with recognizing awareness itself, recognizing, I know that I'm aware. And sometimes in that place of knowing that we're aware, it's, as Alexis says, it can be some less obvious or things that we're not usually familiar with orienting to, that the awareness is picking up on. And so there's often a tendency, I would say there's often a tendency when we know that we're aware but we're not sure what we're aware of, to then decide and say, okay, well, I'll pick something to be aware of then. Let me be aware of my sensation of my knee, or let me be aware of the sound of that car, or the mind actually might start trying to find something to be aware of, trying to land on something, searching for something to be aware of. And so that activity, it's useful to recognize that if that happens, searching is happening. So I'm aware, I know that I'm aware. There may be an initial sense of not being certain of what you're aware of, and then the mind kicks into it. It's not okay. It doesn't feel okay to not know what I'm paying attention to, what I'm aware of. And so this activity of searching starts to happen. So feeling that quality of searching can be interesting. And then what I like to just point to is, you know, as we do get more aware and familiar with that experience of awareness itself, if we're patient there, it's like, yeah, I know I'm aware, I don't know what I'm aware of. It's not so much that I'm saying just, you know, hang out in the awareness, but it's more, you know, keep being curious about what is awareness aware of, but you don't have to go looking for it. It's like, wait for it to come to you, that kind of receptive quality. So this is encouraging more the receptive side of the awareness. So we know that we're aware, we're not sure what we're aware of. And in my own experience, in my own practice, when that happens, often what's happening is that there's something new that awareness is starting to meet that I don't have a conscious name for, or I don't have even a recognition of consciously. And so it can take some patience to hang out in that space. And it's like at some point it might be like, oh yeah, I recognize that one. I felt that one 3 days ago. I still don't know what it's called. But so a patience in that place of being aware and not knowing what we're aware of, to kind of hang there and see what is revealed. To be curious about what the object might be, but you don't have to go looking for an object there. There is an object there. There is an object there. When we are aware, we don't know what we're aware of. There is an object that attention is connecting to, but it may be something that we're unfamiliar with. That's how I would elaborate on what I said the other day.
I want to change my answer. No, I do want. I just want to add one thing, which is, yeah, and as you were talking, that sense that experience doesn't come labeled, right? It doesn't come with words announcing what it is. And I think, you know, that's sort of why the mind, even though it's well established in awareness, it's kind of receiving experiences, and it may be things that are like just vibration or, you know, energy. And it's not, there's nothing concrete or specific, but we know internally, oh, there's a lot of knowing that is happening, but it's not, it doesn't come advertised, you know, this is what I am, I'm a thing. You know, because there's so much stuff that's going on inside. And so I appreciate, yeah, the kind of way of orienting around that, which is when the mind is very awake and aware, there is a lot that is known inwardly at times, and it may not be something concrete, but if you ask your mind, do you know what's going on? It may say, yes, I know what's going on, but if I were to have to try to language it, And then maybe, you know, it may take some craft to do that, or visiting it many times.
So we need to stop. We got through about half the questions, I think. So let's just sit for about 15 seconds. Let the words settle.